Grant Dermody joins me on episode 24 of the podcast. Grant first picked up the harp in Alaska, where he emulated the greats before developing his own acoustic-based sound. He played as a session man on various albums before releasing the first of his four solo albums, which included harmonica duets with Phil Wiggins and Joe Falisco. In between, Grant toured for 6 years with Eric Bibb, and for his latest album, My Donny, he has returned to his roots with a raucous, electrified harmonica sound. Not only a great harmonica player with a strong sense of rhythm, Grant is a vocalist and has penned the lyrics on many of the songs on his albums. A word to my sponsor again, thanks to the Lone Wolf Blues Company, makers of effects pedals, microphones and more, designed for harmonica. Remember, when you want control over your tone, you want Lone Wolf. So, hello, Grant Dermody, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for having me today.
No, you've been having some trouble over there with Hurricane Delta down in Louisiana.
Yeah, that was a big one. I left and went up to visit friends farther north, but I'm going to have to head back in the next day or two.
I think you've had six major hurricanes, I was reading, in the list last year in the south of America.
Yeah. It's a whole different thing than where I grew up in the northwest part of the United States.
Yeah, I've never had to deal with hurricanes. It must be quite frightening to have to experience those.
I haven't been in town for the big ones. I've always left because I didn't want to risk anything. Yeah, when the wind picks up and it starts to batter at your house, it can be pretty scary.
You grew up in Seattle, but before then, I think you lived in Seattle and then you moved to Alaska for a while, and that's where you sort of first picked up the harmonica, is it, in Alaska?
Yes, I grew up in Seattle. My dad was an oceanographer at the University of Washington. And then when I graduated from high school, I moved to Fairbanks, Alaska, and that was where I picked up the harmonica.
What made you pick up the harmonica?
My dad gave me one when I was 18. I just was kind of spinning my wheels and wasn't heading down a road in a very good direction. And my dad, he thought the harmonica might help, and it turned out he was right. It was just the thing I needed. I didn't even know he played. He was a really accomplished violin player, and I never heard him play growing up. And then when World War II hit, he was in the Navy. There wasn't room on the ship for a violin, so he grabbed a chromatic harmonica. He had a great ear for melody. He could just pick tunes out really easily. He's a musical guy, but I just never knew that growing up. Yeah, so I'm in Fairbanks, Alaska, and it's right during the pipeline. So there's a ton of money around, and there's a bunch of places that have live music. There were all kinds of musical genre being explored. There are bluegrass, Appalachian old-time fiddle tunes, jazz, straight-up rock and roll, blues bands. There was all kinds of stuff going on, and I just started sitting in with anybody who'd let me play.
So does that explain your different genres that you play? Because, you know, like you've mentioned a few there, you know, old time, you play country blues, of course, Chicago blues, but you also play, you know, bluegrass yourself. So quite a range of styles. Is that where you picked it up in those early days?
I think so. Yeah. It seemed like early on, partially by choice and partially by being forced to, I needed to make my instrument adapt to what was going on around me. And I learned early on that you can't just play Chicago blues licks in everything that you do and expect it to work. You got to adapt to what the genre needs and what the song needs. And I've kept that all along the way. That's been a lesson that I continue to practice. You know, and then from there, once I got better at the instrument and started to be able to pick up more things, then I started to explore that more deeply. I've always admired guitar players, fiddle players, mandolin players that can sit down with anybody and play anything. And that's what I wanted to do on the harmonica.
So did you start off listening to the classic blues guys? Is that how you started learning the harmonica initially?
Well, not very long after my dad got me my first harmonica, which was like a 12-hole key of C, I think it was. I still have it somewhere. I was literally walking down the street trying to mess with it. And this guy walked, you know, we just kind of met at a cross street. It turned out that he was a harmonica. He knew how to play harmonica. He knew how to get single notes. He knew how to tongue block. He knew how to bend. And he started showing me some stuff. His name was Jackson Hiley, and he's still a good friend. And then another really good friend, we're still very close. His name's Pat Fitzgerald. He was the band leader of a lot of the great bands that were happening in Fairbanks at the time. And he turned me on to Little Walter Jacobs, and he turned me on to Charlie Musselwhite. So he lent me the Little Walter Master double record set and Charlie Musselwhite's Stand Back. And I got lost inside of those records for a long time. And then I started, looking around at other chess artists. So Sonny Boy Williamson, Muddy Waters. When I heard Walter Horton, that was it. He just blew my head right off. And Sonny Terry and James Cotton. And I was just really interested in what other people were doing with the instrument. I was really interested and struck by the harmonica players that could make the harmonica sound big and powerful. The first two people that I heard do that live were James Cotton and Sonny Terry. Get out of my house and don't come back no more. Got to pack it up and go. Got to pack it up and go. Get out of my house and don't. Oh, and then I got really into Slim Harpo, too. I still love Slim Harpo, and I recommend that all my students really dive into him. So I got into Scratch My Back and Rain It In My Heart.
Yeah, Slim Harpo's an interesting one. He's mentioned by quite a few people. I mean, he's probably not as flamboyant or, as great a player. He plays reasonably simple stuff, but very effective. And what is it, that appeals to his playing to you?
Oh, he's got great tone. He's absolutely in the pocket. His note choice is really cool. His melodic sense, I really admire. He swings like a crazy man, and he grooves like a crazy man. And he's doing all of that while he's playing guitar at the same time. So that's pretty amazing.
Oh, great. So you definitely grew up then on this sort of, all the blues greats, harmonica players, and a lot of the tracks you've mentioned. So what made you, get interested in those, the other styles of music that you're playing now? Is that something that you picked up on a little later on, or did you start playing it at that young age?
Well, I spent a long time going pretty hard after that Chicago sound. And I started teaching at blues camps, blues workshops. And I started hanging out with people like John Cephas and John Jackson and Phil Wiggins and Joe Felisco and Ethel Caffey Austin and John D. Holman and Del Rey and Susie Thompson and just a lot of really great acoustic blues players. And so in order to, like I said earlier, when you're playing country blues, you can't just sound like a Chicago blues player who's not playing through the microphone. It requires a whole different kind of playing. You got to be a much better rhythmic player, and you have to have and the sense of melody is a lot stronger as well. And the nuance of the instrument, you have to be careful. You can bury a mandolin pretty easily if you're playing too hard. So all of that, I started playing with amazing musicians like that. And then I started traveling around and going to different kinds of festivals and hearing different people play. And I learned how to play old time fiddle tunes because I wanted to play with Scotty Meyer and Forrest Gibson from the Improbabilities. Forrest and I play blues together too, but that's not really Scotty's thing. But he's one of my top four favorite all time old time fiddle players. I just think he's a tremendous musician and really fun to play with. And so I decided to learn how to play his music.
You're probably better known for playing acoustic style music. So you went away from the kind of more Chicago sound. You started picking up, say you got interested in playing fiddle tunes. And that got you into playing that, being interested in more an acoustic sound, did it?
Yeah. And I really enjoy that sound. One of my absolute favorite things is to do like a house concert with no PA system. So like when I play with Orville Johnson and John Miller, that's our preferred way of doing things. And then I'm also in a duo with Frank Fituski, and we love to do that too. So if we're just in a room with just the two of us and we're just making the sounds that our instrument makes with no help from anything electronic, that's pretty great.
Yeah, and that's nice. People have to be quiet and listen carefully then too, don't they? Which is always nice.
Yeah, they do. But then there's also nothing like plugging into a Fender amp and through an Estatic JT30 microphone and doing that. And that's what my most recent record, My Dhoni, that's what that was all about. We thought it was going to be an eclectic record at first and be like most of my recorded work, where it's lots of different genre all kind of put together. But the electric blues was so strong and so good, and we locked in so well with each other that we decided that the record was telling us it needed to be an electric blues record. There's some Zydeco and some gospel in there too, but mostly it's an electric blues record.
So after your time in Alaska, you then moved back to Seattle, which is where you grew up, yeah? Where we met with Kim Field, who wrote the great book Harmonicas, Harps, and Heavy Breathers.
Yeah. Oh man, that was great. You know, he's a good friend, and we've known each other a long time. I've been playing harmonica 5 years, something like that. And I'd had a little bit of instruction, but I knew that what I was doing wasn't it, you know, I just didn't have it. And, you know, the stuff that I was hearing other people do on records and live, some of it sounded like what I was doing. Most of it didn't. So I started going out and listening to blues bands in Seattle, of which there were many at the time. And I thought Kim was the best harmonica player in town by a good margin. So I hit him up for lessons and we started working together. You know, he had that whole thing. He had that tongue blocking thing at a much higher level than anybody else that I'd studied with. And his tone was fabulous. He had this huge, fat, gorgeous sound. He could really lean into a slow blues. He could swing. And he was a scholar of the instrument. He turned me on to D. Ford Bailey and turned me on to a lot of really good players. So I learned an enormous amount from him.
And again, his book is a great read, and definitely recommend anybody to read that. Like you say, a real scholar of the instrument, and has done a great work with that book that he published. So, and before you picked up the harmonica as well, you were a drummer, yeah? So that was your first instrument?
Yeah, I've always been kind of a rhythmic guy. I was just banging away on my mom's knitting needles at home in like the third grade or second grade or something like that. And she eventually got me a pair of drumsticks. And so I started doing that. I started studying with a classically trained percussionist from the Seattle Symphony. So yeah, I did that in school, you know, junior high school. And then I kind of got away from it in high school. I started playing basketball, and that was where most of my interest was at that point. Dabbled around with a guitar a little bit. But when I turned 18 and my dad gave me that harmonica, that was it. I just took off with it. It's been that way ever since.
People often play other instruments before they come to the harmonica, and there's quite a few people play drums, and that idea that it's, you know, obviously you get that rhythmic sense, which is going to be great to build on, and that's definitely a strong part of your playing, isn't it? So do you think that has had quite an influence on your approach to the harmonica?
I think so. I think the harmonica is very much a rhythm instrument as well as a lead instrument. And I think it's important to be able to do both. So yes, I think whatever rhythm sense I have has definitely helped on the instrument.
If we get into your recording career now, you've got a great discography on your website. So I'll put a link up for that. And again, you play a diverse range of styles. So the first album you've got listed is from 1989 with Michael Getel, which is a beautiful album. I listened to it, really high quality instrumental album. So what about that album?
So I was teaching in a K-12 private school, and the middle school music teacher heard me play at a faculty party and said, "You should be recording. I'm recording a record. Why don't you come and record?" So it was my first ever recording experience. There was no improvising or anything like that. It was a straight melody that was written out. And I think the first 16 bars or something like that are all draw notes. So you just have to have the wind to do it, you know. He didn't really think about what the harmonic can do and can't do. He just played the melody on the piano and said that it sounded good on the harmonica and gave me the music. So that's how that worked. Yeah, Michael's a very talented guy. That was cool. It was a cool first recording experience.
You played on the song The Fullness of Time.
And I played that on the chromatic harmonica.
So yeah, so that was your first recording, and then you recorded with a few different people as a sort of session sort of guy. You did a few recordings with a guy called Jim Page.
Yeah, so that came out of doing gigs. I started performing with him, and then he asked me to be on his records. Jim is an amazing guy. He's a really good singer-songwriter. He writes political songs, protest songs, and he also writes gorgeous love songs. And he's a huge Lightning Hopkins fan and Mississippi John Hurt fan. And he's a much better guitar player than your average singer-songwriter. So he's really fun to play with. In the studio, when I was recording with Michael, and this is not a criticism at all, but it was just, you know, here's the melody, here's when it happens, and this is what I want you to do. I want you to play the notes that I wrote, and I want you to play them at the right time. With Jim, it was a lot more loose and organic than that. It was, well, here's the song, here's how it goes. And we start jamming on it. And if I have a suggestion, I'll go, well, what if we try this? And he'll go, yeah, that's great. Let's try that. Or other times it won't resonate with him. And he'll say, nah, let's try it the other way. So there's this kind of give and take thing going on. That was really fun. I enjoy playing with Jim very much.
Then, so I've got you down here as your first appearance on as a band in your own sort of right was with the Improbabilities in 1998.
Improbabilities, it's like Improbable Hillbillies. Yes, so that was the first time I was part of a band that I was an equal part of, and wasn't just, you know, like you say, being a session guy on somebody else's project. That came out of Scotty Meyer and I playing together in Alaska. We enlisted Forrest Gibson to play guitar, and then we got Richie Stearns and June Drucker on banjo and bass, and we all went down to New Orleans and recorded at Al Tharp's studio. We were there for the better part of a week, and we tracked a record, and it was a lot of fun.
This playing and these people you're playing with mainly around the Seattle area at this point, were they?
Yeah, Jim lives in Seattle. Dan Crary, I'm not sure where he lives, but he was coming through to do recording just outside the Seattle area. So I got called in to do that. Yes, I was living in Seattle and doing most of my playing around there.
So what's the music scene like around Seattle then? Is that pretty good? That's up in the north west of the U.S., isn't it?
Well, it's changed quite a lot. The club scene isn't anywhere near what it was in the 80s. There's just not as many places to play or hear live music. So that's one of the reasons I left to go be in Louisiana.
Yeah, so when did you move down to Louisiana area? Quite recently, was it?
Yeah, pretty recently, about a year and a half ago.
So I'm familiar with the geography down there. Is that reasonably close to New Orleans?
2 hours west.
Is New Orleans part of the scene there, or is that too far to travel to?
I don't consider 2 hours to be a long drive. I know people in your part of the world do sometimes, but it's like you have to get a visa and shots and everything to drive 2 hours in the UK, right?
Well, you're halfway up the country if you drive 2 hours here. Yeah.
Well, that's true. No, it's not a long drive, and so. Lafayette, where I am, has its own music scene. It's Cajun, Zydeco, and Creole. And then there's quite a bit of country swing, quite a bit of country. There's some blues, but the blues is more R&B flavored. And then in Baton Rouge, you have a more traditional kind of blues scene. And then in New Orleans, of course, you have the jazz. So it's kind of cool that, so Baton Rouge is an hour away from Lafayette and New Orleans is 2 hours away. So you don't have to travel very far to get a pretty huge variety of excellent music.
Yeah, so back to your recording career then. So in 2003, you released your first solo album, Crossing That River. What brought that on? And yeah, I think you had 16 other musicians playing with you on that album. So you had quite a mixture of people and again, styles on there.
Well, it was kind of what you were just alluding to. It was, I felt like it was time to do a record, you know, that I'd been playing music for a while, and it was time to have something that was mine that I put out. And what I tried to do is capture the musical relationships that I developed during that time up until that record. And so, yes, some of the 16 people that were on the record were people I knew from Seattle. Some were from other places that I had traveled to. I wanted to capture all of those flavors. And I think we were pretty successful in that. And then Orville produced it and was wonderful, helping me through all of the learning and growing pains that happen when you're doing your very first record.
It's a great album. You know, congrats on the first album of your own. It's really great. And of course, you play with two other harmonica players. You play with Phil Wiggins on Anacostia Two-Step, which is a great tune. And then, of course, you play with Joe Felisco on River of Jordan.
Yeah, well, Joe and I met right when the Improbabilities record came out. We were both teaching at the Augusta Heritage Center Blues Week in West Virginia. And we hit it off right away and just kind of we just were both kind of harmonica nerds in the same way. We were doing a spa thing, and we were doing kind of putting together a performance for it. And he called me up and said, "Hey, let's do River of Jordan," you know, that Alice Martin, J. Bird Coleman thing. And he knew that I would know that tune. And so we got together and we played it and we just locked in. So that was first recorded in the 1920s by J. Bird Coleman and Alice Martin. And to my knowledge, nobody else has done it as a harmonica duet until 2003 when Joe and I did it. That was really fun. And then Anacostia Two-Step was originally called Butt Naked Blues, but Phil toned it down a little bit. He decided to call it something else. That was also in Elkins, West Virginia. We had just finished teaching an entire week with no sleep and basically on our lips, going on fumes when we get to the studio on Friday afternoon, and we got it in one take. We just nailed it, like right off the bat. I don't even know if we tried a second take. I think we might have just went, nope, that's it. Playing with Phil is a lot of fun. He brings a ton of energy to what he does. So that, yeah, it was great. It was fun to do those harmonica duets because not many people do them. And Phil and Joe are both good friends, and I play quite a bit of music with. And, you know, so what do? Do you bring a guitar player and a bass player in and do something? Or what happens if we just play with two harmonicas? That was really fun.
Yeah, great to hear. Yeah, so you don't always get that. Bacon Fat, of course, had two harmonica players famously. But yeah, great to get it, particularly as harmonica fans. So you're known for your songwriting as well, of course. Did you write some of the songs on this first album?
Yes, I wrote Breakthrough, It's All Right, as an instrumental, and then Slow Boat, kind of a folky, slow, ballady kind of tune.
I'm thinking about a slow boat to anywhere, long as I can sail it. And it moves forward, I don't care. Can't afford to waste mine. I'll be gone a long time.
And that's the one that Jim Page plays guitar on so beautifully. Yeah, so those are the three songs I wrote for on the record.
And of course, as well as being a harmonica player, you're the main vocalist, yeah, certainly in your band. So
yeah,
that's an important part you're playing as well, of course.
But that was the first time I'd done any singing on a record. I'd never sang on a record before that record. So that was, yeah, you know, that you got to learn how to do that. So that was part of the deal.
So is that something then that you say you've been a sideman just as a harmonica player? Had you not really thought about being the main vocalist until that stage?
I had sung on as a performer, but always as part of an ensemble. So I was always sharing the vocals with somebody else. I had never carried an entire project vocally by myself. So that was a big deal. It was a big deal to step into that and kind of go get that.
Okay, so, and then you've mentioned that you've done two albums with Johnson, Miller, and Dermody, which is another of your outfits. First album in 2006. So yeah, and then the great second album, We Heard the Voice of a Pork Chop. Well, I mean, what a name. Where did the name from that album come from?
That's the title cut of the record. It's a weird, twisted, obscure blues tune that Orville found, and it's just great. I love playing with those guys. It's a really fun trio. Orville, of course, is a multi-instrumentalist, and so is John. But for the purposes of that band, John holds down the guitar parts, and which he does so well. And Orville plays mandolin, and I play harmonica. And so, and then we all take turns singing. So it's just a blast. I mean, in some ways, it's kind of like Sleepy John Estes, Yank Rochelle, and Hammy Nixon. That trio had that same instrumentation. Yeah, so that was really cool. So that it's just, we just get together and we have fun and we throw tunes at each other. Performing and recording with those guys and just hanging out is always just one of my favorite things.
Some of those great old blues songs, as you say, from the 1920s have these great names, don't they? You can dig them up and they have these names like that. So
yeah, it's great.
In 2008, you started playing with Eric Bibb. Yeah, so how did that come about?
I was teaching at a blues camp in Telluride, Colorado, which it occurred at the same time as the Telluride Blues Festival. So Eric was coming in, playing the festival. He came in and did a workshop for the students at the blues camp. And at the very end, he asked if I would play with him. We just did a shuffle. We just did one of his tunes. I think it was Don't Let Nobody Drag Your Spirit Down. So after all of this teaching and all of this talking about music, he just, you know, got up and played and asked me to join him. And he just loved what I was doing. And right there, he said, will you play with me on my main stage set? I did. So lots of people would have had me play in the middle of the set in case I didn't play all that well. They would have had time to recover. He had me play the last two songs of the set with him. So he was a gutsy guy. And then that started 6 years of playing and touring with Eric. And I think I'm on like six or seven of his records. And I've traveled all over the U.S. and U.K., Ireland, France, Italy. And we did a lot of playing together over a six-year period.
Yeah, he's great, isn't he? He really got that authentic blues sound about him, hasn't he? And he doesn't really do solos, does he? He's more of a rhythm playing, so you get the solos when you're playing with him a lot of the time, don't you?
That's the deal. Yeah, I was the only soloist, and we traveled as a duo most of the time. And so the trick there is to just make sure that the solos sound fresh and new with each song.
And the song you mentioned, Don't Let Anybody Bring Your Spirit Down, I used to play that song in a band, and because a friend of mine, he was in the band, used to really like Eric Bibb. So that's his song, is it, that one?
Yes, he wrote that song. His mother said to him, you know, that's the song. If they only give you one song, that's the song that you play. I played that song with him every night that we played for a long time. So it's a great tune. It always got the audience up and going and clapping their hands and really responding.
So great. A song I love where you're playing on the Get On Board album, which is the second one you did with Eric, called New Beale Street Blues. That's a great one, real great feel to that song.
Yeah, that's a cool tune. It's got a nice melody and it's got a nice feel to it.
Yeah, and then in 2010, you did your second solo album, Lay Down My Burden. I think you had 26 guest musicians on this time, so they've definitely got the draw to get the musicians on.
Yeah, that was a tough one. You know, my dad had just passed away, and my mom and my wife were both very ill. It became a bunch of different things. It became an outlet. I was the primary caregiver for 2 years while my wife was battling cancer. And she passed away in December of 2009. And so she got to hear the album and she got to see the artwork, but she didn't get to see the final pressing of it. But she sang on it. And that's something that would have really scared her at another time in her life. But she figured, well, man, if I can deal with all this cancer stuff, I can sing on a record. So we sang Hard Times Come Again No More together with two dear friends, MHB Conant and Rich Hill.
Hard times, come again no more. Many days you have lingered around my cabin door. Oh, hard times, come again no more.
So during that 2 year period, I would just grab some time to play some music with different people, sort of like I did on Crossing That River, but with different kinds of songs. And more bluesy, I think, maybe in some ways, than Crossing That River was. I ended up playing with three blues musicians that I greatly admire, John D. Holman, Louisiana Red, and John Cephas. The Hard Time Killing Floor Blues that we did on that record, that was John Cephas's last recording. So there was a lot of loss that was going on right then. It was a way for me to deal with it. It was a way for me to express what it was all about. It was a way to talk to friends about it musically rather than sitting down and having a conversation.
It's really interesting you hear you say that. I didn't know that was obviously the history of the album, but it really comes across. I was listening to the album and it does really have a kind of really mournful feel about it, some of it, doesn't it? It has that. I can almost feel the pain there at the time. It does come through, I think, on that album.
I didn't want it to be a dirge. I didn't want it to be something that was just so heavy that you couldn't, that you had to like gear yourself up to listen to it. And I don't think it came across that way, but I've heard from many people that it helped, it has helped them when they were going through similar losses.
And a song I really like on there is David's Cow. What about that one?
Well, it's so D. Ford Bailey did an instrumental called Davidson County Blues. He took that from a piano tune called Cow Cow Blues by Jed Davenport. I've been playing that song as a solo instrumental for a really long time. And Scotty and Forrest from the Improbabilies both really liked that tune, and they just kept asking me, you know, play that tune some more. I think I want to see what we can do with that. So Scotty added a fiddle part, Forrest added a guitar part, and we recorded it. And so David's Cow is just a play on where that song came from.
And then the next album, the first time I heard you play was on this album, the Sun Might Shine album. Yeah, I really loved that album. And, you know, it's to say when I discovered you. Again, you know, different styles on there. And this, the title track, Sun Might Shine, great. I love those lyrics. Did you write those lyrics to that song or was it somebody else?
I wrote 8 of the songs on that record. So I wrote 3 originals for Crossing That River, 3 on Lay Down My Burden, and then I wrote 8 for that one. It ended up, there were some songs about grief, but the grief was from looking at it from farther down the road. And that's where the lyrics of that song are. You know, she's gone, it's all right. Sun's going to shine tomorrow. She's gone, it's all right. Sun might shine on me. You know, you got to move on. You got to keep moving. You got to feel what there is to feel. And you can't numb it out and you can't run away from it, but you can't get lost in it either. You got to keep moving and living. A lot of the record is about that.
Oh, yeah, it's all right. Sun might shine on me.
So that record was the first record that Dirk and I worked on. And Orville was co-producer as well. And Dirk and I had done some recording and some touring with Eric Bibb toward the end of my time with Eric. We hit it off musically and personally, and I asked him if he'd be willing to work with me on my next record, and he said, yeah. So I went down to Louisiana, and we recorded it in his studio, and I was really happy with it. It's good. I think it's a strong record. If you look on the liner notes, you know, Dirk plays on like 9 different instruments and sings harmony and engineers and co-produces. And he had a lot to do with that record.
I think the thing which really makes an album good is the atmosphere that it captures. And, you know, it has an atmosphere. I think the album is really, really great. I really love that one.
Thank you.
One of them is excuse my pronunciation, is J'ai passé. Is that a Cajun tune?
Yes, it's a traditional Cajun tune. And it was taught to me by my friend Jerry DeVilliers. He's a Cajun harmonica player born and raised in Eunice, Louisiana. And he's one of the best harmonica players I know. He's easily the best living Cajun harmonica player. What he does with the instrument is tremendous. So he taught me how to play that tune. So I kind of did that to honor him. And because the record was recorded in Louisiana, it was kind of a way to add a little Cajun flavor to it.
Yeah, no, it's good. Again, the different styles on there and then hearing that Cajun. It's great to hear. Very effective on the harmonica.
The accordion and the harmonica are so closely related, you know, that, I mean, that's the deal. It's like in that part of Louisiana, accordion is king. It drives the Cajun music. It drives the Creole. It drives the Zydeco. So if you know what you're doing on the harmonica, you can make the harmonica sound like an accordion. And that was a deal with Jerry. Jerry's mom gave him a harmonica when he was 5 years old, and he taught himself how to make the harmonica sound like an accordion. All the hardest stuff there is to do, he can do, and he's completely self-taught.
And then your most recent album, really well put together in 2019, is My Donnie album, which you touched on earlier on. So this, I believe, is it still under consideration for Grammy nomination? Is that still something that's going through?
Yes. So the way it works is that somebody who's a voter has to submit you to be considered. And then if enough of the voters, enough of the eligible voters vote for you, then you get to the final 15, I think it is. It might be 12, but I think it's 15 in a given category. And then if that happens, then your record gets listened to by the judges for that category all at once with everybody else's. And then if you make the final five, then you're a Grammy-nominated record. And if you win, of course, then there you go. We are waiting to see if we make the final 15 right now.
Great. So good luck with that. That's obviously always good to get on those sort of lists, isn't it, to help, raise a profile and everything. So, yeah, good luck with that. So it's not something that external people can vote on. Is it just decided by a judge?
There's a committee of... I'm not even sure how many there are. I want to say there's like 12,000 voters or something like that are eligible. And in order to vote, you have to apply. And people in the music business need to write recommendations for you and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of voters from all kinds of musical worlds. Yeah, so that's the deal. So the public, you know, people who are fans have said, you know, I love your music. I'd love to help. Can I vote? What can I do? And at this stage of the game, there isn't anything really except to hold good intention. So we have to get enough of the 12,000 voters to like our record and vote for it.
Well, good luck with that. And the category is the Best Traditional Blues Album, which is in contention for, isn't it?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah, so that record, the way that came about, it was time to do another record. And I said to Dirk, do you want to do another one? And he said, yeah, you know, let's do it in my studio. So he was doing another recording with Rhiannon Giddens, and her rhythm section was in town. Jamie Dick on drums and Jason Cypher on bass. So we just sat down and we started playing blues, and it sounded really good. We just locked in. We all felt where the pulse was and where the grooves were and how they needed to be. And so, again, you know, my previous three records were pretty eclectic. This one's eclectic, but it's within a certain genre. I play more amplified harmonica than I ever have on a recording. I mean, it's pretty much a blues record, I think. You know, yeah, there's some gospel. Yeah, there's some Zydeco, but it's mostly a blues record. It was really fun to do. And it's been very, very well received. It's got great airplay all over the world. It's gotten really good press. We were very pleasantly surprised and gratified by the response.
Yeah, and I think you recorded it live in the studio.
We did, except for the vocals. Yeah, the vocals we did later, but all the instrumental stuff is live. That means, of course, that, you know, whatever solos you come up with, that's your solo. You don't get to fix it. So you got to be in the moment and really just bring everything you have right there at that time. And the trick is to play as well as you possibly can. Some people play carefully, like they play to not make any mistakes. You can't do that. You got to push beyond that and just go for it. If you have four people or five people, when Corey came in and played accordion with us and joined us for the Zydeco stuff, when you have five people that are just going for it with no fear and no reservation, and some pretty magical, powerful things can happen.
And you mentioned that, as you say, this is pretty much a full electric album for you on harmonica, which, you know, you normally play acoustic. So it's a slight change from your recorded material from that point of view. But listening to it, you know, you really push, you know, the electric sound. You're going for quite a heavy, sort of dirty, distorted sound. It's almost as if you've sort of gone, right, I played all these years of acoustic. Now I'm really going to push and get us kind of, is that something you deliberately went for on that sound on the harmonica?
Yeah, because that's what the songs required, you know? I mean, I think that, you know, the songs had a certain nastiness and bite to them. And so I wanted a dirty, kind of a nasty sound. And in some ways, it's kind of circling back to how I started, you know? I started my harmonica journey going pretty hard after that Chicago sound. I kind of returned to it for a whole record, which was really fun. Yeah, so I think that amplified sound and that bite that it gets was just the right thing for most of those tunes. So, you know, when we did that Springtime Blues, that 8-bar tune, I played acoustic for that because that was a better choice. And then Great Change, that gospel tune, I played acoustic on that because that's what that song needed. But the rest of it's electric.
And some interesting lyrics again on there. Now, I was going to ask you, is 35:59 based on a real experience?
Sort of. That's all I'm going to say on that one.
She's 35, I'm 59. You know I still got lots of time. Oh, babe, I can love you strong and slow.
It's kind of a thing where you get to, there comes a time as you get older where you have to start paying attention to age and what's going on. You know, when you're 20 something and you're 30 something and 40 something, you know, if you meet somebody who's a few years younger, a few years older, it's not a big deal. But as you get older, it becomes a big deal. At least it does to me. And so it's just kind of a humorous way of looking at that particular situation. 35 and 59 is a fairly significant age spread. That's what the song was about. Just talking about what it's like to kind of be aware of that, feel that. So it's actually written kind of tongue in cheek about a friend of mine in Seattle. I told her the song was coming and she cracked up. She thought it was hilarious. So that's the background on that tune.
And we touched on writing lyrics. So, you know, a songwriter yourself. So, you know, what about this, you know, writing kind of modern blues lyrics? You know, you do that very well on your albums, and it's something which does kind of bring the music up to date, isn't it? Instead of, you know, just playing all the old classics, which we all love, yeah, but it's nice to get those up-to-date songs, isn't it? And, you know, is that something, you know, you've really tried to develop and, you know, almost bringing the blues into the modern day?
I think in any music that you play, but I think, well, I mean, because what I spend most of my time playing blues, I guess it's more in the forefront for me. You got to tell the truth. You got to get underneath it. You got to dig deep and soar high, and you have got to tell the truth. You have got to sing about something that you know. You know, I don't drink, so I don't sing about drinking. You know, I wrote some songs about experiencing loss because that's what I was going through, and it was a way to get that out and do some healing, but it was also a way of communicating with other people that might be going through the same thing. The lyrics that I write have to do with kind of what I'm going through and what I'm thinking about and what I'm... So there's spiritual lyrics, there's love, not being able to find love, love that didn't work, love that did work, you know, and then there's, yeah, so that's what most of my songs seem to be about.
And then... a recent record you recorded on a hip-hop song, All Love with Lucid Dreams. So that's an interesting one.
Myron is... So one of the first people I met when I moved to Louisiana was Elizabeth McNabb. And she's a local gal. She's a huge music lover. She ran a radio show for quite some time. And her boyfriend, Myron, just kind of asked me one day. He said, I'm doing a record. It's kind of hip-hop, and I want to bring some blues into it. Do you want to play? And I said, sure. So he sent me a kind of a work tape, and I listened to it. He had a home studio kind of all set up. Yeah, I went over there, and I think we did like three passes, and I'm not sure which of the ones he took, but I've heard it, and I like what he did with it. He's great. He's a really, really good person. Young guy, full of talent. He really respects the roots that he is drawing from. He knows very well that the music that he does has a huge blues background, and he pays attention to that.
Yeah, I always thought that, you know, harmonica could work in a hip-hop sense, so it's great to hear you've done that. So another thing you do lots of, and you've touched on a few times, and you played in lots of teaching camps where you've met lots of the other musicians that you played with. Teaching's a big part, isn't it? And you're still teaching a lot now, and you're teaching these camps, aren't you? You're teaching the certainly in the UK where I live, in the Eurobluz Week, where you've met my friend Pete Wheat. So, you know, what about teaching? What's your involvement in teaching at the moment?
Well, you know, when I started, there I had like two main people that were just really willing to pass on what they knew, you know, Jackson and Kim. And it's kind of been that way ever since. I just, you know, I move down the harmonica road and I meet people and, you know, maybe they're doing something in a way that I don't do. And, you know, we talk about it. They show me how to do things. I think passing it on is part of the deal. It's just something that I think is important to do. So I think tone is really important. I think you need to learn how to make the harmonica sound good. So I work with my students on that a lot. I think it's important to be a strong rhythmic player as well as a strong soloist. So we work on that a lot. I also think it's important to be able to improvise. So we work on that. I want them more than anything else to develop their own voice on the instrument. I don't want them to imitate me or Little Walter or Big Walter or Cotton or anybody like that. I want them to learn from the masters, but I want them to have their own voice. And so those are the things I think are most important about teaching. You know, it's important to learn the great songs that people have done in the past. You know, there's great music that precedes us, and it's important to be aware of that music and learn from that music, but not to recreate that music note for note on stage. Doing a Little Walter solo note for note on stage is not okay. You got to do your own thing. If there's a melody, like if you're going to do blues with a feeling and do that an opening melody thing or something, fine. But then do your own solo. Do something else. And then I guess I'm coming back to something that you asked me earlier. But one of the things that was happening with that record, Sun Might Shine on Me, is that here I am 6 years down the road from my wife's passing. And, you know, what am I feeling and what's going on? And I started looking around for songs that were saying what I wanted to say, and I couldn't find any, so I wrote my own. And that's kind of where that comes from. So yeah, so I want my students to have a big, open, fat, relaxed tone, and I want them to be able to serve the song. I really enjoy teaching. I think it's one of my favorite things to do, and it's really cool when somebody gets to a place that they haven't been to before, and they hear it, and you hear it, and everybody in the room hears it. It's pretty great. That'll keep you going for a while.
Yeah, and you're still doing online teaching during this time as well, aren't you? So I'll put a link on for that.
I am. Yes, I'm accepting new students. That's how a lot of us are trying to keep going during the pandemic.
A question I ask each time, which links very strongly with what you just talked about there, is if you had 10 minutes to practice, what would you spend that 10 minutes doing?
Well, I'd probably pick up a G harmonica because I love that sound. It's just got that big, deep, rich sound. And I'd probably just start with playing how I'm feeling at the moment, just kind of see what comes. It wouldn't necessarily be somebody else's song. It wouldn't necessarily be somebody else's groove. If I had 10 minutes, I would just sit down and play what's inside of me and just let it come out.
I mean, you touched on it a little bit yourself, you know, about your style of playing. You said a lot of it, obviously, based on acoustic. You know, you know the importance of playing rhythmically is something that you really, you know, I think is important. Playing bass line, playing chords, you know, fat sound. All these things, you know, really go to make up your style, I think.
Yeah, that's true. All of those things, I think, are important. But, you know, the thing about music is that there's so many different ways to be musical, and there's so many different ways to express yourself. And there's, you know, I mean, if you're just looking at the harmonica world, you know, you could go down the Chicago blues road and that could take you a long time. And then you could go down the country blues, Sonny Terry, pre-war solo stuff, and you could do that. And that would take you a long time. You could do the overblow jazz thing, and that could take you a long time. There's so many different paths and there's so many different ways to do it. I'm sort of interested in everything, so I do a lot of it at the same time. But it's important to play what's inside of you and so that it's the truth. It's important to play what the song requires in your own voice. That's really what it's about. And so you never get there. That's one of the really great things about music is that the better you get, the more you realize how much we're all works in progress. And you just continue to understand that you're a work in progress, the better you get. The higher up you move, the more there is to know, the more there is to learn. And it never stops. You know, I'm always searching for bigger, fatter, more open tone. I'm always searching for being able to dig deeper, soar higher, tell the truth. I'm always searching for ways to serve the song that I haven't explored before. So no, that's all the stuff that I love to do and never get tired of. And I'll be pursuing that until I take my last breath, hopefully with a harmonica in my mouth.
Well, it's great to hear, you know, that someone, you know, who's been playing as long as you have and albums under your name, that you still feel, have that attitude to learning and that, like you say, you're open to it all and it never ends, does it? So great to hear. You mentioned earlier on that you play some chromatic, so you certainly have recorded some chromatic, haven't you? For example, you've got It's All Right on the Crossing That River album. It's played on chromatic. So is chromatic something you play much of?
Not nearly as much as the diatonic. It's something that I've been spending a little bit of time with lately, and this winter I plan on playing quite a bit more. I'd like to get to a place where I'm a fluid soloist on the chromatic harmonica.
And would that be blues or in other genres as well?
I'd like to get into some jazz, you know, start being able to do that. Mm-hmm. At the spa thing that I was, you know, talking about, I've heard incredibly good chromatic jazz harmonica players. Charlie Layton's the best I've ever heard. Of course, I've heard Toots Thielman a lot, too. He used to come to Seattle a lot, and I love what he did. There's a guy named Mike Turk that lives around the Boston area. He's fabulous. And anytime I start listing harmonica players, I'm always going, I'm going to leave somebody out that's amazing. So that art form is something I admire, and it's not an art form that I do well at all. And I'd like to work on that. That's just another path, right? You know, and I mean, and for some people, that was their whole path. You know, that's wonderful. We all benefited from that.
So we'll talk through gear now and run through which gear you use. So first of all, what harmonicas do you like to play?
I'm a marine band guy. I play custom marine bands made by Joe, my buddy Joe Felisco. And he kind of gaps them and he adjusts them to how I play. I play hard. I play very hard. I move a lot of air when I play. And Joe does, you know, anybody who knows harmonica knows Joe Felisco. So, yeah, he does tremendous work, and I'm very grateful to play his harmonicas. And then as far as chromatics go, I've got a Toots Thielman hard bopper and a mellow tone. And then I've got a Meisterklasse that has long, you know, more notes. And that's what I do. When I sing and play acoustic, I play through a Beyer M69. It's got a really nice range for the harmonica and also my voice, which is lower pitched. Yeah, I've got an old Estatic JT30 that's got a volume pod on it. So I can dial it down for comping and I can dial it up for soloing. And then I've got an old Champ, like a 1970s Champ that I use for small gigs. And I've got an old vintage Bassman that I like a lot, and I've got another Fender Blues Deluxe that I like quite a bit. As far as gear, that's it.
Sorry, which amp did you use to record the My Donny album?
I used one of Dirk's amps. He had another Fender. All of my amps were in Seattle at the time, so I used one of his. He had I forget what the brand name was. It had two 10-inch speakers in it and had a nice dirty sound. But that's it. I don't use pedals. I don't use octave things. I'm probably the least techie gearhead that you've talked to harmonica wise. I just, you know, I'm more, when I play acoustic, I want it to sound just like I play in a room. The acoustic sound should be the same thing as the sound with no amplification at all.
Yeah, I was going to make that point exactly, you know, because of your approach to playing largely acoustic, you know, it's exactly that, isn't it? And like you say, you like that kind of, you know, real sound in a room kind of sound, which is great, and using hand effects and, you know, all the effects you need, yeah?
Yeah.
So what about a favorite key of diatonic? I take that's a G diatonic from what you said earlier.
I love G harmonicas. I really like low harmonicas. When I was doing the Improbabilities record, I stumbled across low-pitched harmonicas. There was a fiddle tune we did called You Piney Mountain, and I used a low D on that one. Because if I used a regular D, I was going to be right exactly where the fiddle and the banjo were, sonically. So I went underneath them and found my own space. So I like low-pitched harps a lot. Yeah, A's, B flats. But it's also true that vocals drives the tune. I have to figure out where the best key for me to sing something is and then choose the right harmonica from there.
Yeah, because I've noticed, because I often like to guess which is a favorite key, and I definitely notice you like the low ones. But then I also notice that quite a lot of your songs aren't always played on the low ones. You know, you certainly do a few on the C harmonica and a few others. So I was thinking, I'm not quite sure what his favorite is, because you do have quite a mix of keys that you use.
Yeah, and most of that comes down to vocals. You know, you gotta deliver the song in the right key when you sing it. I used to do it the other way around. I used to choose the harmonica I wanted to use and then try to make my voice work with it. I don't recommend that. That's not the best way to do it.
But you mentioned low-keyed harmonicas, and obviously there's great, you know, great rhythmical playing. You know, they got that beautiful sound to them, fat sound. But they can, you know, they sort of sit below the mix a little bit, don't they? They may be more suited to rhythmical playing in some cases, and they don't quite cut through the same as the higher keys, do they? So do you do something to try and address that when you're playing? Or
I just play really hard. I can take it up into an extra, I can kick it up a few notches when I really bring it, and I really breathe from as deep a place as I can. So I don't, so that works out that way. And then, you know, years playing on jam sessions with a million different musicians all playing the same blues tune at the same time, you learn how to make your instrument cut.
And what about any different tunings? Do you use any?
No.
And what about overblows?
No, never did that. It was never a sound that appealed to me enough to want to pursue it.
And what embouchure do you use?
I tongue block most of the time. I pucker the bottom three holes most of the time because I adjust the inside of my mouth a lot to get different shades and sounds of the things that I'm doing. And so puckering enables me to do that in a much better way, in a much broader way than tongue blocking does.
So you use both, but you're mainly a tongue blocker.
Yeah, I mean, you could say that I pucker the bottom three holes and tongue block everything else, but that's not always true. Sometimes I tongue block the bottom three. I play a lot of intentionally sloppy notes, like especially if I'm trying to fatten up a melody. If I'm going up into the, you know, if the melody calls for a 4, 5, 6 draw, I might widen my mouth out a little bit and make that an intentionally sloppy sound. I like those sounds. I like those dirty kind of raspy sounds. Like for instance, if you're doing something on a C harp and you're playing Sitting on Top of the World, the way I like to play that melody is to kind of give it some grit and give it some dirt instead of having it be all single notes.
And so then final question, what about your future plans? Obviously, you've just got your album, My Donny's, just recently come out. And what are you planning to do, what we can do at the moment, of course, with the pandemic going on, but any plans?
Well, I have three things going on right now, three balls in the air. One, I wrote a song for the woman, M.H.B. Conant, who sang on Hard Times Come Again No More. She passed away last July. I wrote a song for her, a hymn, and I'm getting some help from some Irish musicians. There's a friend of mine that lives in Spittal, Ireland. His name's Charlie Lennon, brilliant Irish fiddle player. He's going to play on it. Dirk's going to play on it. And then Dirk knows a vocalist, an Irish soprano in Cork, who's going to sing on it. So it's going to be about peace. It's going to be kind of like an Irish version of Dona Nobis Pacem, which means grant us peace or give us peace. So that's one thing. That's kind of in the works right now. We're going to do a follow-through to My Donny. We're going to do another electric record so that when touring opens up again, we'll have two strong records in our back pocket that we can tour off of. So we'll start that in the spring. And then I just finished tracking an acoustic blues record with my good buddy Frank Fatusky, just duo, just harmonica and guitar. And we're dedicating that record to John Jackson, who was a huge mentor to both of us, a Virginia blues guitar player and singer. So those are the three projects that are happening right now. And then, you know, continuing to teach, I'm going to be working on putting an instructional DVD out at some point soon. And that's what's going on right now.
So, it's great to hear you keeping nice and busy and plenty of stuff to look forward to. And hopefully see you touring next year. And hopefully you come over to Europe. I'll definitely come and check you out and say hello.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for the interview, Neil. It's been great talking to you.
That's it for today, folks. Final word from my sponsor, the Lone Wolf Blues Company, providing some great effects pedals and microphones, all purpose-built for the harmonica. Be sure to check out their website. Grant, tell us all about that Tree of Life.